Field Robotics with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi and welcome to the 110th episode of Robots. My name is Jana, and in this episode, we'll hear what's going on at the Centre for Field Robotics in Australia from Professor Sala Sukarye. But first, here are the news with Christine.
Thank you, Jana. This Monday, August 6, 2012, at 5:14 a.m. UTC, the NASA's Mars Science Laboratory Curiosity successfully landed on Mars. As you may have heard in our previous news reports and in the last Robots podcast episode where we took a tour of the open house at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, or JPL, the Curiosity Mars rover is the by far largest and most complex robot to ever land on Mars. Launched last November, this week's successful landing was a culmination of the craft's 9-month journey through space. More importantly, it was the most critical moment of an effort involving thousands of engineers worldwide and marked a huge milestone in our exploration of Mars. Over the next days and weeks, Curiosity will run a comprehensive list of checks and tests on both its own state, making sure all of its instruments work correctly, as well as its surroundings, checking that it has landed on stable, safe terrain. The Curiosity rover will then begin to use its unprecedented array of scientific tools, including the ChemCam's laser spectrometer that can vaporize and analyze soil samples from up to 7 meters distance. Curiosity's mission time is 2 years. However, it has no finite lifetime elements, so we may well be able to look forward to scientific insights for even longer. For more information on Curiosity's successful landing on Mars, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com.
The Australian Centre for Field Robotics, or ACFR, at Sydney University conducts some of the world's largest and most innovative research and development in an incredibly diverse range of areas, ranging from aerial and defence to marine and agricultural robotics. The Centre's researchers are addressing the needs of national and international governments, industries and publics. Sala Sukarye is an associate professor at the centre and spoke to our reporter Per about the ACFR and some of its exciting research projects.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. Today we are at the Australian Centre for Field Robotics with the director, Professor Sala Sukarye. Maybe we could start with an introduction of the centre.
So the Australian Centre for Field Robotics has been around now for about 15 years. It's an institute, a research institute within the University of Sydney. There's just over 100 researchers at the moment. So we have about 55 PhD students. There's full-time academic staff, and there's a number of research fellows, about 40 research fellows across the group. And we work in various areas. So as the name says, we're a field robotics group. So we like working with robotic systems that work outdoors predominantly in the field, and that causes a lot of different problems when it comes to robotic work, and we have to deal with many different research areas that you wouldn't normally find in an indoor application. And our work is spread over various areas, so we work in marine and aerospace, ground vehicles, we work for mining, stevedoring, agriculture, environment work. We're starting to dabble into social robotics, both media robotics as well as medical robotic applications. So there's a whole wide spectrum of activity that we deal with. And in all of those activities, we generally have research that focuses on probably 4 key areas, and they mix and match in different ways. One of them is perception. So how does a robot understand its world and deal with its world, especially in a dynamic world environment, unstructured world environment? Control or decision making is probably the second element, and very much about how do you deal with making decisions and actions in a very stochastic, uncertain world. The third area is the relatively recent area, which is in machine learning, data mining, and how that impacts robotic technology. So not just machine learning algorithms, but putting them, using them in real time, using them within the environment. And the final area is in what we would call systems or modeling. So how do you start to build and construct complex autonomous systems and their interaction with other humans and other systems? So systems are systems concepts. And a lot of our industrial applications deal with that kind of an area as well.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about any particular project you've been working with here?
Okay, so we have, so if I look at the aerospace world, we've been working with robotic aircraft now for about 13 years in different ways, both what we'd call fixed wing and rotary wing, so all, you know, just standard aircraft that you'd normally expect, as well as autonomous helicopters. The work started a lot in security and in defense in the early years, mainly dealing with multi-robot systems. How would they share information statistically, build a common view of the world? That moved on to active decision making. So once we've got this common view of the world, how do we then make informed decisions, no operator input, to do things such as search or map or track? That kind of drove the technology. Then was very expensive for the ordinary user, the civilian user, so that's why it was mainly driven by government and defense and so forth. But then about 7 years ago, you could really see the transformation of the technology. It got cheaper. You could start to buy autopilots off the shelf. You could start to buy robotic platforms off the shelf. So the civilian industry or the civilian area started to get a lot more interested in the application. So we then started to get some research work from the government to look at robotic aircraft for environment mapping, weed detection, animal tracking. These are just some of the examples that we've had in the past. Completely different philosophy to how you would approach the problem. While in the first group of activity that you worked on, you had a very technical or educated industry partner. People were very technically orientated. They could understand the technology a lot better. They knew what the risks were. They knew what the potential was, but they also knew what the limitations were very easily. You start to talk to the civilian areas about this, that they assumed that these things could tackle very, very large problems, and it was a lot more of an education to what the limitations were and so forth, and trying to drive the cost down. And a lot of that technology now we're starting to see transition into civilian aviation, commercial aviation realm. So even though they're not interested in automation, a lot of the technology, sensors, algorithms and so forth that we had developed in the past are now kind of starting to feed into those areas. So you kind of see a train of different activities, you know, both from a very technical savvy audience being defense industry to an audience that just wants to see something work because they think it will solve all their problems, but why doesn't it work properly, etc., to another audience which is interested not so much in the automation but in the technology spin-offs that came out of the automation process back into aspects such as commercial aviation. That's one example. Another example is mining. We have Australia is a very large place where most of the population lives on the eastern seaboard, but all of our mineral wealth is located in the center and out to the west. Not many people want to work out there. With the mining boom that we've had recently, over the last 5 years maybe, there's been a lot of interest from mining companies to actually look at automation to help solve both their labor but their efficiency costs as well. And so you can go out now to Western Australia, you can see a large amount of activity there with autonomous haul trucks, and people starting to think about in 10 years' time, what is the mine of the future going to look like? And we've had, again, over the last 15 years, a lot of involvement with various mining companies. At the moment now, we have a sub-centre, which is called the ACFR Rio Tinto Centre for Mine Automation. And that has about 15 research fellows, just as many PhD students, and a number of software, mechanical, electrical engineers. And we work with Rio Tinto at looking at some of the aspects about solving some of the concepts that they're looking at for the mine of the future as well. Environmental applications is another one. We have a lot of, so in addition to the robotic aircraft activity that I mentioned before, there's the similar type of activity in the underwater realm. So we have an underwater robotics or a marine robotics group, and they work a lot with scientists and marine biologists and government agencies to look at mapping predominantly coral reefs and classification of corals, and looking at change detection over a number of years to see whether things such as climate change or pollution or whatever it might be are affecting that. And that helps in terms of being able to deliver imagery that they could never get before, as well as help with reducing the amount of imagery that they need to look at by looking at automatic classification, identification of that imagery and helping marine biologists being able to identify changes in the environment. So that's just some of the examples, I think, mm-hmm. that look at the activities that we have here.
Yeah. You said that the center is about 15 years old. How was it started?
So at the University of Sydney, there's a group within the, so the school is called the School of Aerospace, Mechanical and Mechatronic Engineering. So back 1991, something like that, there was a mechatronics program started. There were three full-time academics involved in that activity. They had been doing some robotic work in various areas. In 95, 96, the group appointed a professor, Hugh Durrant-White, who came from Oxford. And his drive, I guess, was to actually look at field robotics, so start to look at machinery outdoors and robotic systems outdoors. So the group started with that. There was three or four PhD students that came on board. And our first flagship project, I guess, was at the time I was a PhD student, the first flagship project was probably the automated straddle carrier project, which was looking at port operations and automation of port operations. So we did a lot of research work in the area of navigation and control. The next flagship project was probably the multi-robotic aircraft activity, which was sponsored by BAE Systems. And with those two flagship projects, it kind of grew, you know, the number of PhD students, research fellows, engineers, and slowly, you know, one thing kind of led to another. One project kind of, you know, showed your worth and what the center was capable of, and that kind of drew in the next one, and kind of rapidly grew to what we have now, which is just over 100 researchers in the area.
Mm-hmm. So you're doing all this now, and you're, of course, going to continue to do that, but where do you see the new exciting projects for the future? You're doing what you do now. What projects are you starting now, or would you like to start now?
I think the environment and agriculture are probably big areas, at least in Australia anyway, big areas that we think robotics will have a very positive influence on. The problem that we have now is that labour is costly in the area, where Australia is competing against much more labour-intensive but cheaper labour costs, you know, within the Asia and South America area. So the agriculture industry has to kind of compete against that. And at the same time, we're not getting enough labour in that area because they're either not coming to it or they're going to mining or something like that, you know. So there's not enough labour coming to that area. So being able to do things where you can run farms a lot more efficiently and effectively, know more about your farm, collecting data, harvesting, pruning, etc. So that whole process, I think, has a fruitful area to deal with in the future. The environment, I think, is another big thing for Australia. There's massive land mass, water mass that we need to deal with, and not enough in terms of remote sensing and manipulation or sensing of the environment, but also touching the environment in various ways, whether it's ground or air or underwater, and knowing what's going on, both in terms of ecological models that help scientists, but also in terms of just land management uses and things like that. So that's one big area. Another big area would be intelligent transport systems. So it's looking now more at it, robotic systems, but in a context. So everything's kind of transitioning away from the robot itself, but then how is the robot used and in what context is it used and how does it kind of fit within that bigger picture? And that draws on other challenges. Human-robot interaction, human-robot interfaces is one thing. Many robots, heterogeneous robots working together, how do you deal with that? Cooperative control, coordinated control, other aspects such as architectures to allow robots to talk to each other. There's aspects like that we need to deal with. So I think they're kind of like the big areas. But then also, you know, you start to look around some of the other transformational technologies like cloud, machine learning, etc. So how do they then also transform robotics and where the future of robotics is going into? So I think we're trying to understand those areas and how those areas fit in along the way. But Australia has a very unique area. Whether it's better or not, it's a different question, I think. But a unique area in the sense of we're just as large as the US or Europe in terms of landmass. We have a large economic zone in terms of the water mass around us. But we only have 24 million people, and they all like living near the beaches on the East Coast. So there's a lot of challenges there, but a lot of unique opportunity for robotics. So I think there'll always be things such as in mining and in defence, in border protection, in environmental monitoring. There'll always be those activities that I think will drive it. But I think it's just the transition now of not just the robot, but the robot in context.
So when we talk, for instance, about using this in farming, are you seeing this as something that are we going to have a high-tech farmer that uses a lot of robotics to monitor his farm? And I guess you, again, have a very unique problem here in Australia because a farm in Australia can be very, very large. Mm-hmm. If we're talking the cattle farms, they are
hundreds of thousands of hectares. Yes,
yeah, massive, and there's simply no way you can go out and have a look.
No, that's right. And that's what I think the future will be. Okay, so what I should say, there's lots of technology pieces that you can bring together that will allow that to happen, and the know-how is there to be able to do that. In the operational context about a farm, there are many issues that we need to deal with, but you know, we know how to build the robots, we know how to deal with communication over large distances, human robot interactions, your human robot interfaces, or one human controlling many robots. We know how to look at perception issues and how that feeds into control, etc. How it works on a farm is a different question, and that's really where the challenges are now, and understanding how you might use the robot in that context. But I could envision that if you weren't to worry about money, and if you weren't to worry about commitment, I guess, so people would go in the long run, you know, 5-10 years time, you can start to see autonomous farms in that context. Harvesting is always the trickiest issue, but many of the other aspects that you could probably solve quite easily with the technology that we have.
Which means that you could actually remote into your farm, because if you use robotics, you can actually live in Sydney except for the 2 weeks when you harvest.
Exactly, and we do that now in mining. We do that now in defence. There's nothing to say we can't do that in agriculture as well. There is obviously a mind shift. There is obviously, you know, people understanding of how robotics would be used in that context. But you can envision that that's how you would take it and where you'd go. But also not to forget, there are also concepts of the urban farm as well, which is a multi-story, you know, farm operation that are operated autonomously as well. It doesn't have to be I'm going out to the middle of, you know, wherever to be able to deal with my farms. But I think in both those areas of what the future of agriculture might hold, robotics is going to have a key area, a key element in that.
You talked about autonomous transportation. Is like that automated lorry transportation, or is it cars, or?
So in Australia, I think it's probably more got to do with transport systems that support things such as long haulage operations.
Basically automated mining, road
trains. Exactly, yeah, or mining vehicles, trains, systems, truck, dispatch, you know, freight, etc. So a lot of those aspects, I think, will be important in the future. And again, to support things such as mining, agriculture.
This leads to a very interesting question that you're probably perfect to answer. And this is just when we step out of the enclosed space, and we do what the Center for Field Robotics, I mean, go out there in the nitty-gritty world. Do you think that, how long time will it be? What are the hard questions around actually taking the full step of being fully out there? As you said, interacting with people and other vehicles. Are we going to be able to do that soon, or is it further in the future? What are the main issues around that?
I think it's one of those things where it's not less about the technology, it's more about the commitment of the partners that you're working with. Do they want to go down that path or not? Is it easier for them to just segregate an area and just say, we're going to do it here because we don't want to deal with all the OH&S issues and aspects like that? Technology-wise, yeah, I mean, there's things that you could throw in now that would help, you know, do things such as dealing with human-robot interaction. or manned, unmanned, or many different types of systems working with each other. They're probably not perfect, but if you had the commitment from an individual to be able to, or company or whatever it might be, to take it that further, you'd know what you'd need to tackle in order to be able to solve that. So I wouldn't say that the technology is an issue in that particular case, except for little bits and pieces here and there that I think you could solve. It's more of a commitment of whether the collaborator, the partner that you're working with, wants to take it down that path. But at the moment now, it's a lot easier to just segregate out an area and just say, you know, it's going to be autonomous.
Certainly. And I guess we also need to work with interfacing with governments and regulations. I guess you have to do all the research around documenting that these systems are, in fact, safe. I mean, we can yes. claim them to be and stuff. Do you think that that would be a hard part of the problem? Documenting and proving, in one sense, that they are safe?
Well, I think in things like that, you've got to prove both from the level of the science and the research. So my algorithms, my sensors, I can prove that if a sensor fails, it can be detected, et cetera, et cetera. Mathematically, I want to be able to do that, scientifically, algorithmically. But then also the engineering aspect. So, you know, the redundancy that you need to do in terms of hardware and software to be able to make that work. And then there's proving or validating that whole concept under different scenarios. When I'm working in the field, it could be, you know, fog, smoke, and all of a sudden my laser, my vision system doesn't work. And, you know, how am I compensating for all that with another sensor, different types of algorithms, et cetera. So you have to, it's not just, here's the documentation. It's that it's from the beginning when you start to think about the problem, the science behind it all, the algorithms that you want to implement, then the development phase and what you need to do in terms of redundancy and checking and so forth. Then the proving on the ground itself under those different scenarios. So you still have to sit down and say, you know, capture the requirements of the operation itself and be able to put that in there, because we're not at a position yet where we can say it will work all the time under every situation.
So time perspective on this part of the research, do you think that, I mean, if we started this research now, when could we come to and to the authorities and say that a autonomous vehicle or a robot of some kind is safe to operate in this environment, say on the road, or
we can do that now, but it's a case by case basis, right? So you can do that. So you can, whether it's in, say, stevedoring, you can sit down and say, this is what it is, but how do we deal with that? Well, I mean, the fundamental thing will be making sure that you don't accidentally injure or kill anyone, any person. So, as we said before, segregating, but then proving that the segregating of that system works, and then back down to the individual vehicle, and how do you know the individual vehicle won't just run away, et cetera, and proving that that works. I think the case with Google, say, for example, in Nevada, it's a very unique special case. Whether that catches on and follows with everybody else is a different story. But at the moment now, like you said, 99.9% of the rest of the world won't, you know, hasn't taken that leap yet, that leap of faith yet. So I think it's, and then whether it works on that particular vehicle itself, in a particular situation and scenario, whether I can transport that whole thing across and just throw it in the middle of Australia and off it goes is a, you know, it's,
we know for
it,
instance,
you need to prove that as well.
Yeah, we need to know, for instance, that they cannot take snow. And they've said that. We don't work well in the snow. So, I mean, and of course, this is a thing I've talked to other roboticists about, that as long as the robot can know its own limitation, we're kind of okay. It's probably not good to stop at the highway, but it's much better to stop than to hit something.
Yeah, but as with all these things, you don't know everything, right? There's those unknowns that can creep up and just pop up in front of you. So that's why I think it's safer at the moment. Now, without moving away, you know, without kind of getting scared of what the future science is in that area, from a let's go out there and actually apply it and make it work, develop it, commercialize it, or see it in operation, it's safer to constrain the environment and say, this is the requirements that this robot's going to work under, and you develop towards that.
Yeah, so that's what we're doing today.
And that will stay like that for some time.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, okay. So that's probably a challenge to the new students and PhDs to push that limit.
That's right, but then you start to open up into other areas, predictive maintenance or preventative, you know, health monitoring aspects, self-healing or self-understanding, and then provability of your software, and there's many other issues that start creeping into it that fit outside of robotics. And so, you know, it's a question of how robotics itself kind of pulls that in. or whether it's something that's developed outside and pushed in. You know, this
isn't this a good indication that robotics is kind of starting to mature, that we're having these problems?
Yeah, I mean, we're not, at least when it comes to industry, we're not in a position anymore like before where we would say, where we'd have to say, believe us, you know, we know what we're doing. Now you can sit back and you can say, these are the projects that have been done in the past, these are the capabilities. So now we're interested in how we're going to apply it to your system. So I think from that perspective, it shows there's maturity in the overall process. We know a lot more now. We know what sensors work, what doesn't work. We know what algorithms work under certain situations. We know how far to dabble in the control and the planning to make it. And we're kind of getting to the other point where we're saying, where we're becoming a lot more mature as roboticists in terms of dealing with industry and saying, well, taking the requirements that they're telling us and then kind of housing or fit or developing and designing a robot that works within that particular context. Yeah. So, and I think the other aspect of maturity is we know our limitations as well. You know, well, before, gung-ho and off you go, and or you might be too scared to say anything, and now you kind of, you're confident in areas and you know where the limitations are and what needs to be done. So you can go to play, you can go to a new project and you can say, this would be development, this would be research, this probably doesn't fit into the category any at this point in time until we figure out a bit more about the underlying problem.
Yeah, yeah. So now we can actually invite industries in and we could work with them to develop, as you say, robots that assists them in whatever they're doing. And as we can give them a predictable line,
that's right,
road ahead.
Yeah, there's a lot more confidence now in when you're talking to industry saying what you know works, what you know doesn't work, and what you know you don't know.
Yeah,
you know, and that, you know, is probably an open question. You don't, probably don't want to have that in this project now because it will just take us years and whatever. Let's just see how we do with this one. Or you might be interested in that, or that might be what the government's interested in. Hence, it's a separate source of funding and dealing with that.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So this is actually an invitation to industry out there that has some interested in this and they see potential, that want to know whether their project or what they think could be done, and also just come to the roboticist and explain your industry, and they will see and they can say, okay, we could help you here, that's probably in the future, well, this area we shouldn't go to at all.
Yeah, and I think it requires, I mean, it requires industry to be, you know, to be confident and understand that, you know, look, there are capabilities and technologies there that may benefit. On the other end, there's the research end or the academic end. It's also them becoming a bit more aware about industry requirements, in the sense of, it's not about, oh, look, yeah, we can solve that, give us this whole bag of money and we'll over-engineer a whole system to make it work. You know, you've really got to work within the parameters of not just the mission scope, but everything else, you know, all the other costs that come into the process as well. And so it's a focus on the research or the academic or whatever it might be to actually understand a bit more about those other aspects to the problem.
Thank you very much. And I think we'll be back for more about all that is going on at the Center for Field Robotics soon.
And that's all for today. We hope you enjoyed this episode about field robotics in Australia. As always, you can access plenty of additional information and the opportunity to let us know what you think via our website at robotspodcast.com. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Until then, goodbye. Field Robotics with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.